registradas en el distrito 18 de Mesa.
En 2010, November, Russell Pierce got 17,552 votos. And we're prepared today to turn in 18,315 signatures.
La agrupación Ciudadanos por un Mejor Arizona reunió 18,315 firmas, más de los votos que obtuvo el poderoso republicano en las elecciones de noviembre y el doble de las necesarias para convocar a elecciones para destituirlo. Pierce no solo ha impulsado legislaciones antiinmigrantes en Arizona, sino que ha convertido ese estado en modelo para otros sectores de extrema derecha a lo largo de Estados Unidos. El republicano Russell Pierce dijo a una reportera de televisión el 19 de mayo, después de participar en un evento organizado por el Tea Party, que no tomaba en serio los intentos para removerlo de su puesto. Dijo que aquellos que buscan destituirlo son un montón de anarquistas que no tienen respeto por el Estado de Derecho.
Sends a very strong message to every state legislator that extreme politics will no longer be tolerated.
Chad Snow, organizador de la campaña para desaforar a Russell Pierce, dijo que buscan enviar un mensaje al republicano y a toda la legislatura de Arizona de que no tolerarán las políticas extremistas en el estado. Los voluntarios que recaudaron las firmas señalaron también que el republicano Pierce se ha enfocado demasiado en medidas antiinmigrantes, en lugar de trabajar en los temas de la educación, salud y otras preocupaciones de la población en Arizona. El gobernador de Nueva York, Andrew Cuomo, anunció que el estado dejará de participar en un programa federal para identificar a migrantes indocumentados a través del intercambio de información entre policías locales y autoridades migratorias. El Departamento de Inmigración y Control de Aduanas asegura que el objetivo del programa Comunidades Seguras es identificar y deportar a peligrosos criminales del país. Sin embargo, el gobernador de Nueva York dijo en un comunicado que decidió abandonar el programa después de concluir que no está cumpliendo con sus objetivos y que supone serias consecuencias para testigos, víctimas de crímenes y la propia policía. También este año el gobernador de Illinois, Pat Quinn, anunció que su estado se retiraba del programa Comunidades Seguras porque promueve la deportación de personas que no han cometido crímenes. La administración Obama deportó en el año fiscal 2010 una cifra récord de casi 400,000 personas, lo que ha generado resentimiento entre la comunidad latina, que lo respaldó con su voto en el año 2008.
El retorno del expresidente Manuel Zelaya a su patria, Honduras, 2 años después de ser derrocado y expulsado por militares y políticos pro-estadounidenses, está generando críticas. Si bien el acuerdo de Cartagena, firmado por los presidentes de Venezuela, Colombia y Honduras, permite el retorno de Zelaya, que la resistencia hondureña opere ahora como partido político y que se realicen plebiscitos nacionales, deja en limbo legal el castigo para los responsables de asesinatos, secuestros e intimidación de disidentes y periodistas. James Petras es experto en política exterior y relaciones internacionales.
Yo creo que todavía hay varias cosas que deben ser juzgadas, porque uno no puede simple olvidar que muchos murieron en la lucha contra la dictadura, contra Lobos, contra el golpe. Hay muchos crímenes, hay muchos periodistas asesinados, dirigentes campesinos. Y el hecho que Zelaya vuelve a Honduras no cambia el hecho de que hay muchos crímenes contra el pueblo que deben ser juzgados en alguna forma. Y el hecho que Zelaya cree que todo el proceso de lucha es simple sobre su retorno es absolutamente falso. No era simple el retorno, era un programa social, un programa de derechos humanos, de justicia, de legalidad. Me parece que Zelaya muestra sus colores liberales más que su preocupación por los sacrificios que hicieron para que la democracia vuelva. Y yo creo que es un drama en Honduras que la gente que sacrifican, que mostraran su capacidad de luchar, tienen que terminar con un político que simplemente está celebrando un pacto con los golpistas.
Ahora se va a forjar una coalición de campesinos, obreros, estudiantes, intelectuales para avanzar la revolución hondureña. Quieren empujar una asamblea constituyente para hacer un gobierno de abajo para arriba. ¿Usted qué dice de eso?
Yo creo que eso es necesario porque lo que existía antes durante la campaña de Zelaya era un frente encabezado por un sector disidente del latifundismo, la ala más progresista del liberalismo y una formación política con el eje en obreros y campesinos puede ser más consecuente, más capaz de convocar el pueblo para cambiar su situación y no simplemente hacer cambios cosméticos y legales. Eso me parece muy importante porque Honduras hasta ahora tenía que sufrir de competencia entre un sector de la oligarquía contra el otro. Incluso el señor Zelaya y su esposa son dueños de grandes terrenos y creo que es bueno que han tomado posiciones favorables al pueblo, pero el pueblo solo puede liberarse a través de sus propias esfuerzos.
Parece que Washington se ha consolidado un poco más ahora con Lobos en la presidencia, ¿no?
Bueno, en alguna forma sí, porque pusieron sus clientes en el poder o los devolvieron al poder, pero lo que salió de la lucha es un enorme movimiento, una gran lucha y una gran conciencia política y social. Y eso no existía en las campañas de Zelaya. Ahora sí, a partir de la lucha contra el golpismo y contra el respaldo norteamericano, han recibido nueva conciencia, más antiimperialista y más antioligárquica. Y el frente de resistencia en Honduras es eso. No es simple una repetición de la campaña zelayista de antes. Es una nueva situación ahora. Y Zelaya debe reconocer que las cosas no vuelven a los viejos canales del pasado. Zelaya, sus antecedentes no son muy favorables para una política de confrontación y movilización contra las fuerzas dominantes en Honduras. Lo que hay que ver es el grado que Zelaya han aprendido de las luchas del pueblo en su ausencia y debe adaptarse a eso y no buscar viejos amigos y colegas en el Partido Liberal. Y cuando habla de una alianza más amplia, ¿qué significa eso? ¿Más allá de los obreros, campesinos y clase media pobre o está buscando algún sector del poder existente para conseguir suficiente respaldo electoral?
Pues no sé si usted quiera comentar sobre el tino, la medida de retornar a Honduras a la Organización de Estados Americanos sin hacer muchas concesiones.
Bueno, yo creo que ya está arreglado entre Chávez, Santos y Lobo el asunto, que Zelaya vuelve y Chávez apoya la entrada de Honduras en la OEA y todo está arreglado ya. Yo creo que hay que entender que hay una conciliación de Chávez con Colombia que va hacia una acomodación frente a la agresión norteamericana, busca a conseguir alianzas con sectores conservadores y eso puede ser favorable diplomáticamente para Venezuela, pero no sé si va a impactar favorable para la lucha de los pueblos.
Era James Petras, experto en política exterior y relaciones internacionales.
Estás escuchando el Informativo Pacífica. Si deseas comunicarte con nosotros, puedes escribirnos al correo electrónico pueblossinfronteras@gmail.com.
Ponele mucha atención a esta canción de corazón. Es más lo bueno que aquí tenemos, más los que queremos, creemos en esta tierra. Es una bendición. Mira Honduras con otros ojos, y esta es tu tierra.
Noticias de Libia. El periodista Rolando Segura informa que la población cerca del complejo residencial del líder Muammar Gaddafi está siendo impactada fuertemente por los constantes bombardeos de la coalición de ejércitos europeos conocida como la OTAN.
Trípoli insiste en mostrar su mejor cara cada atardecer. La gente intenta olvidar que desde el cielo o el Mediterráneo en cualquier momento comenzará una lluvia de misiles. El blanco principal de los ataques, detrás o frente a este muro.
Venimos aquí todos los días, esta es una calle abierta. ¿Por qué nos bombardean? Somos civiles.
Ellos muestran restos del misil que hace apenas minutos estalló en el perímetro de la residencia oficial de Gaddafi. Los periodistas se alejan con premura porque los cazas de la OTAN aún sobrevuelan. Aquí el impacto de uno de los ataques, pero justo al frente están viviendas. Vecinos muestran sus casas. Algunas fueron afectadas.
Corrimos para el cuarto de los niños cuando sentimos el estruendo. Nada grave, pero ellos se asustaron mucho. ¿Cómo es eso que están defendiendo a los civiles? Mira estas heridas.
En la mañana esta escuela también se vio impactada por bombardeos a plena luz del día contra Bab al-Azizia.
Nosotros no somos militares. Las bombas cayeron al lado de la escuela. No entiendo por qué tienen que hacernos esto.
Ellas hacen ahora sus exámenes con una doble incertidumbre. Por un lado ponen a prueba sus conocimientos, pero por otro la capacidad de resistir fuertes bombardeos. Como hoy, unos 470 estudiantes realizaban aquí durante el último ataque los exámenes del segundo semestre.
Fui testigo del temor de mis alumnos, pero también de su valentía, de no querer dejar los exámenes para irse a casa por el bombardeo.
Pero algunas sillas aún están vacías. Por miedo o por falta de combustible, sus padres no traen a los hijos a la escuela.
Israel ataca todos los años, diariamente al pueblo palestino. ¿Por qué la OTAN no va a protegerlos?
Mientras decenas de personas día a día siguen viniendo al blanco preferido de la OTAN en Trípoli. Bab al-Azizia es un sitio para cantar, bailar, reír y también llorar.
Mi hijo me dice, mamá, tengo miedo cuando siente las bombas. Yo quiero a Gaddafi. Ahora Gran Bretaña dice que va a lanzar cohetes mucho más fuertes. Y los rebeldes dicen que si entran a Trípoli van a degollar a todo el que apoya a Gaddafi.
Bombardeada una y otra vez, la residencia de Gaddafi insiste en ser bastión de resistencia. Todos hacen votos por la paz para detener más de 70 días de bombardeos que han quitado ya la vida a 718 civiles y han dejado heridos a más de 4.000. Rolando Segura, Telesur, Trípoli.
El segundo banco de Islandia ha tomado una medida sin precedentes en el sector financiero, tras haber sido nacionalizado en su totalidad para evitar la quiebra en 2008, ahora quiere compensar a los ciudadanos por pagar su rescate. Desde el colectivo Más Voces, Rafael Cuesta reporta.
Hablamos de Islandia y de una manera diferente de afrontar la crisis que está siendo silenciada por los grandes medios de comunicación. El segundo banco islandés, tras haber sido nacionalizado en su totalidad para evitar la quiebra en el año 2008, el Landsbankinn va a devolver intereses y ayudas a las personas con hipotecas con el fin de reducir su endeudamiento. Esta iniciativa podría beneficiar a unos 70.000 clientes de la entidad y responde a su juicio al compromiso y responsabilidad social corporativa ante la sólida posición financiera por la que atraviesa después de dos ejercicios de crisis. Los clientes de Landsbankinn podrán percibir el 20% de los intereses pagados desde diciembre del año 2008 con un máximo de 6.000 euros. Pero también ha puesto en marcha una medida para ayudar a aquellos que no llegan a fin de mes y no pueden cumplir con los compromisos de la hipoteca. Para ello, en lugar de calcular el valor de la vivienda en función de la tasación del inmueble, pasará a establecerse a precios del mercado, lo que provocará una disminución de la deuda por la caída en los precios de los inmuebles. El banco islandés, además, da otra solución a sus clientes. Landsbanking reducirá la deuda de aquellos ciudadanos cuyos números rojos estén muy por encima de la capacidad del pago del prestatario, tras un análisis previo de la entidad. Esta medida, según explicó en un comunicado, permitirá reducir deudas de hasta 4 millones de coronas, unos 24.000 euros. Para acogerse a ese beneficio, el cliente se comprometerá a pagar la cantidad pendiente en un plazo de 3 años. La decisión de devolver dinero a la ciudadanía se produce en medio de la disputa judicial que Islandia mantiene con Reino Unido y Holanda, y es que la ciudadanía islandesa se negó en referéndum a devolver unos 4.000 millones de euros que los bancos británicos y holandeses adelantaron a más de 320.000 personas tras la quiebra del iSafe, una filial del Landsbanking. El gobierno tuvo que llevar a consulta pública la decisión de reembolsar el dinero ante la revuelta y desencanto social suscitado en Islandia. Y la ciudadanía dejó claro que no tenía que pagar los desmanes y el mal hacer de la élite bancaria que creó la crisis financiera global. La crisis provocó el colapso bancario y el Ejecutivo decidió nacionalizar 3 bancos como condición para rescatarles con dinero público. Los 3 bancos fueron el Glitnir, Landsbanking y Kaupthing. Por tanto, Islandia vive una revolución desde 2009, cuando se hizo dimitir a un gobierno al completo, se nacionalizaron los principales bancos, se decidió no pagar la deuda que estos han creado con Gran Bretaña y Holanda a causa de su execrable política financiera, se encarceló a los responsables de la crisis y se creó una asamblea popular para reescribir su constitución. Y todo ello de forma pacífica, a golpe de cacerola, de gritos y de unión social. Este hecho no gusta nada en la conservadora Unión Europea, que teme que cunda el ejemplo por otros países tomando medidas que no favorezcan a banqueros y grandes empresas y que no sigan sus dictados de recortes sociales y privatizaciones, debilitando el papel de los estados. El movimiento 15M del Estado español reclama algunas de las acciones que la ciudadanía de Islandia ha obligado a tomar a sus gobernantes, entre ellas que las decisiones importantes en materia financiera, como los rescates bancarios, o cuestiones tan relevantes como los recortes de servicios sociales y las privatizaciones de los servicios del Estado, sean siempre llevados a referéndum.
Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And coming up next on Free Radio at 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org, it's of course Bathrob Spears Broadsides. What else did you tune in for? Stay tuned. And that was They Don't Make Love Like They Used To. Again, another selection from something I've been playing from past shows, Voice of the Homeless. And welcome to Bathrob Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert, a.k.a. Bathrob Spear Robert. And you can reach me online here, or I should say in the studio as well as online. Call into the studio if you'd like, 831-427-3772. 427-FRSC, or catch me off air at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Questions, comments, and stuff of that sort that you don't want to talk about on the air. Also trying to scare up volunteers for civil rights work in Santa Cruz. We do that every week, too, at the HUFF meeting, which we had yesterday. It's every Wednesday now at 10 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific in downtown Santa Cruz. Check it out if you're interested, or just get in touch if you have some concerns or some reports or, as I said, some questions at 423-HUFF. And if you have comments on what you're hearing on the air right now, it's 427-3772, 427-FRSC. You can also reach the hotline for the studio, I should say actually the cold line, the voicemail for the studio in case you have a donation, some general questions about other shows, or just anything having to do with Freak Radio here in Santa Cruz that isn't specifically concerned with my show. And that number is 427-4523, 427-4523, 427-4523. If you run and get a pencil, I will repeat all these numbers very briefly at the end of this rapid patter, and you can write them down if you want, or just call the HUFF line and leave me a message, and I'll get back to you with information like this, or go to freakradio.org, which is where we're also streaming, and you'll get more details on schedules and some archives, not so much of this show, but of other shows on Freak Radio, how to apply, things of that sort. Freakradio.org. Again, the numbers are 427-4523 for the voicemail, if you have a public service announcement, something like that. For the on-air broadcast, or if you want to point out to me that my voice is far too low or far too high or there's something wrong with what you're hearing, or there's something you want to comment on what you're hearing, 427-3772, 427-FRSC. And finally, 423-HUFF is the number to call for all other questions, including what's happening with the next show, how you get access to older shows, and so forth. The HUFF website, I think, is still out of commission in spite of all my earnest pleas, but I'm going to keep pleading with the people in charge of it and hope that they will put it back online or do what they can or at least let me know what's going on, because that's always good to know. Sometimes it's not so good to know, but it's better to know it than not to know it. Yeah, the HUFF website is still be back soon. That was the message a week and a half ago, and it's not soon enough for me, I'll tell you. Anyway, today in about 45 minutes, I'll be having an interview, I'm hoping, with Tony. It's either Ciampi or Ciampi. I'm not sure which. I'm getting two different pronunciations from two people, both of whom apparently know this man. He has been struggling in court against the Palo Alto Police Department and legal authorities who, by my analysis, and although, of course, I'm not a percipient witness, just a guy who reads the news accounts and reads his emails and has talked to one of his former attorneys, he's been falsely arrested. Evidence has been doctored. He's a guy who lived in his van in Palo Alto where it's legal to actually sleep in your van on the streets. He was lured out of his van by police who then, when he was uncooperative, tasered him. Even though they had no basis for stopping him in the first place or luring him out, it was a trap. And he was then arrested and he was tried. Judge dismissed all charges. He sued the city and he was getting somewhere, but then a federal judge gave a summary dismissal, which means dismissal out of court before trial, to the defendants, the city and the police. And so now he's back at square one, doing some more work on the case, trying to get attorneys to help him, and appealing, I would imagine. But we'll hear more from him soon, I hope, again, in about 45 minutes. His name is Tony Ciampi, or Ciampi, S-I-A-M-P-I. We'll find out both how it's pronounced and what's going down, hopefully around 7. I'll be doing a little more talking about that case as it gets closer to 7 o'clock. So, I'm looking at the stuff I prepared for the show. I ran into a couple of articles that seemed interesting to me. In Berkeley on Telegraph Avenue, which is sort of similar to Santa Cruz's Pacific Avenue, although the Telegraph Avenue abuts directly the University of California. And in the past, there's been a more active activist community there, though. If you talk to traveling Berkeley activists who attended some Santa Cruz peace demonstrations, they'll tell you it ain't as active as it used to be, which, of course, is also the case in Santa Cruz. But here's an article from the Daily Californian, which is the newspaper put out a couple times a week by the University of California students, which is, well, this article is may betray a little of the conservative, I call it taint or direction that newspaper is taking. Police patrol program leads to less loitering on Telegraph. With regular police patrols, loitering on Telegraph has experienced a marked reduction, resulting in fewer public disturbances, according to business owner Al Geyer. And this is by Amir Mugathaderi, who wrote the article, if I've got it right. Or it could be Amir Agathaden, not too sure here. With regular police patrols, standing in front of his business on Telegraph Avenue between Hayes Street and Channing Way, on Friday afternoon, Al Geyer, chair of the Telegraph Merchants Association, that's kind of like our downtown association here in Santa Cruz, you know, Chip, the inimitable Chip, who's the head of that association here, he observed relatively sparse amounts of foot traffic and people hanging around outside. However, this has not always been the case. In the past, crowds of people have been prone to linger and disturb the area around Annapurna, the business Geyer has owned since 1969, he says. I'm not quite sure what Annapurna is. I'm sure I must have walked by it a number of times. Also, his perspective was very much unlike mine. I was up in Berkeley a week ago, more or less, and there was plenty of traffic. It was on the weekend. So maybe, actually, I was up there both on a weekend and on a weekday, too. So it was sort of a mix. A lot of traffic when I was there. So, don't know. But this is the experience of this reporter, apparently. Here's some tourists walking up and down the street with their family. Here's a man and a woman walking. That doesn't happen when this other thing starts to happen. You certainly can't walk down the street with a baby when you have people yelling at you, Geyer said. Those people aren't here right now. I have never observed anybody driven off Telegraph Avenue or Pacific Avenue in Santa Cruz, for that matter, by people yelling at them. Though, of course, we get reports of people who won't come back because they've been panhandled or had a bad experience. That's true. That's, of course, the reason that the excuse or the reason or the so-called justification for the creation in Santa Cruz of the very harsh downtown ordinances that criminalize most sitting down on Pacific Avenue, severely restrict musicians, severely restrict even peaceful spare changing, and are generally the pretext for police moving up and down harassing performers at the whim of any particular critic who happens to call the cops. But getting back to this Berkeley story, this time last year, Geyer said, groups of what he described as aggressive people would form in the area and act disruptive, which he said often resulted in physical altercations. In today's climate of high-speed communication and organizations via social media, Geyer said problematic groups have also been well-coordinated, able to regroup within an hour of being dispersed. It makes it sound like a serious conspiracy downtown in Berkeley. But since the Berkeley Police Department launched a Walk the Beat pilot program that ran from November to January, such groups have largely dissipated, Geyer said. Again, that was not my experience when I was up there a week ago. I saw a number of groups, and they were hanging out on the sidewalk, and they were chatting with each other, and some of them looked pretty ragged and poor, and some of them were taking up a certain percentage of the sidewalk, but you could walk past them. They didn't harass you. Some people would ask you for change, but, you know, isn't that sort of a natural thing to happen when people are poor and the economy is sinking into the toilet day by day and so forth? And isn't that protected by the First Amendment? Well, not according to Mayor Ryan Coonerty or apparently Mayor Tom Bates of Berkeley. Anyway, I'm throwing all my interjections into this Daily Cal story, but you can always read the original for yourself. It's online. Again, if you just look for police patrol program leads to less loitering on Telegraph. You'll find it. Reading a bit more of it. During the program, a police officer would be assigned to patrol the Telegraph area on foot and monitor potentially disruptive situations, according to City Council member Chris Worthington. Geyer said this type of police presence engages those who cause problems more effectively and could create more lasting changes to overall safety on Telegraph. Lots of key suggestive words in here that I suspect are not backed up by any kind of documented police reports around actual arrests, around actual crimes on Telegraph Avenue, other than merchants being annoyed with the very presence of certain groups of people who they don't like, who they feel does not help their businesses and so forth, which, of course, is a familiar kind of lament for merchants in any city and in Santa Cruz as well. This public sidewalk is, of course, an area that merchants would prefer, many merchants. It would be a closed, private, gated area that they had much greater control over, that they could shoo people away from at their whim, and that they could use sort of as a simply a gateway to their cash registers and their businesses. This is understandable for commercial interests, but of course not healthy for the broader multi-purposed uses of a downtown area. And that has always been, I think, a fundamental blindness that merchants have had. I admit, I, however, am an advocate for from the other side, which is that I think we're in such danger of losing our public spaces, and we have lost great substantial amounts of public space in urban areas, that the job of the community is to defend and restore those public spaces. And merchants, they have their problems, and they should be listened to and so forth, and they should be taken into account. But they cannot be allowed to control either the law or the policing of these areas, which seems to be what's unfortunately happening in cities all over the country. Again, Councilmember Chris Worthington is cited in this article. Geyser said this type of police presence engages those who cause problems more effectively and could create more lasting changes to overall safety on Telegraph. Again, these words, safety, danger, terror, you know, that sort of thing. Nice kinds of justifications, but again, as I asked when I asked now Mayor Coonerty, what's the documentation for essentially declaring 10 square blocks of Santa Cruz, all that in the parking lots and garages, a no-go zone for people unless you're walking through or parking your vehicle, even those people who want to sit in their car and read a book? And where's the proof that these are, you know, high crime areas that need to be fenced off, patrolled, and have people essentially banned from these areas unless they're doing very specific things? And he didn't have the stats. And the stats were never provided to our downtown commission. Instead, we simply got the power exerted to criminalize people in those areas, which happens only because the police are selective in their criminalization, to people that the police want to interrogate, look over, or drive away, which are frequently poor and homeless people. These people can only really be dealt with when you're on foot, Geyser said. It doesn't work to drive by and just check it out once in a while. You need to have a presence. I've been here 40 years. It makes a huge difference. Members of both the police, Berkeley Police Department and the city manager's office could not be reached for comment. Of course, that also means it's easier to harass, intimidate, and drive along people if you're on foot, and you have blanket ordinances that allow you to do that without any actual crime being present, sure, that's why Officers Winston, Forbus, and Warren, who walk around on Pacific Avenue, and Sergeant Harms, when he was doing that, can exert a, I guess what merchants regard as a very healthful and salutary influence, what others regard as a repressive and intimidating influence and a sterilizing influence on Pacific Avenue here in Santa Cruz. Worthington, Chris Worthington, city council member, is now hoping to see the program installed permanently. I guess that's the police patrol program, because he said it is important to maintain safety in the area, which is close to the UC Berkeley campus and generates a large portion of the city's sales tax revenue. This surprises me to hear that Councilmember Worthington is supporting this particular program. Perhaps there's more crime in the area that I know. In the past, he's been one of the few council members who has, to some extent, been supportive of the street community, or not be that, maybe that's a little strong, but opposed to the drug war, opposed to criminalization of the poor, supportive of homeless civil rights. Perhaps that's all changed, or perhaps this reporter is not getting it right. I'll have to get in touch with Worthington, who's been on the show in some years past, and see what he has to say. It makes people feel like the police are paying attention, Worthington says, and I think it also preempts the problems from happening, Worthington said. Worthington said he has his biggest obstacle to seeing the program permanently established is obtaining an itemized city budget. Though the city council did receive budget summary as well as a department budget listing, an itemized budget would detail the exact cost of each component, which Worthington said he needed in order to know what, if anything, can be adjusted to provide funding for the program. And maybe this is a reverse approach to show the kind of costly involvement of police. I mean, it's been my impression that police are spending a lot of time and money on Pacific Avenue going after people for petty infractions which have nothing to do with public safety, like sitting on the sidewalk, playing a guitar for more than an hour in one spot, having a political table, sitting down next, having a political table within 9 feet of a building, singing songs with questionable lyrics outside the bookshop Santa Cruz that disturb a day sleeper, a whole series of concerns, walking in a parade without a permit, which are really designed to counter the potentiality of public protest around larger issues in Santa Cruz and I assume also in Berkeley. I think these things cost a lot of money comparatively. In fact, several hundred thousand dollars, I believe, was given to the city attorney to deal with these infraction crimes, so-called infraction crimes, which the police kind of created, and they weren't just doing it on Pacific Avenue in Santa Cruz. They were doing it two blocks over to get rid of Peace Camp 2010, the homeless protest that was peacefully but continuously maintaining a presence in front of City Hall, demanding that Mayor Coonerty pay some attention to the basic civil rights and basic needs of homeless people, which he was militantly ignoring in terms of supporting the city's anti-homeless sleeping ban law, closing off the city grounds at night, closing off the library grounds at night, increasing city funding and increasing city attorney involvement in actions involving activists who oppose him on this. So, yeah, I think the economic issue is an important one, particularly in a time when the city's budget is, both in Berkeley and in Santa Cruz, becoming an issue of serious contention. Continuing with this story, what if I wanted to eliminate a program? Well, it doesn't tell me how much that program costs, he said. You can't know what to move around if you don't have the details. See, that's interesting. He's talking about eliminating, not expanding or maintaining. So I'm wondering if this writer who thinks he's supportive, Councilmember Worthington, is supportive of more police patrolling. And apparently it's at least one of the quotes seems to indicate he is. But if there aren't other programs he might want to eliminate that might have to do with police harassment of poor people. I'm being speculative here and hopeful in my thinking, and I guess I'll have to find out what's going on. The council will vote on the budget June 28th, by which time Worthington said he hopes he'll be able to provide funding for the program in some way as the summer progresses and the weather gets better. More people have historically been drawn to the area. Geysers had a permanent police presence on foot, he said, could prevent an aggressive atmosphere from taking root by motivating some people to leave the area. And there it is. Of course, he wants police aggression against people to get rid of people that make him nervous. And, of course, that makes him the aggressor because he's funding this kind of crap and supporting it. This is the merchant who runs Annapurna, apparently. Ultimately, the word gets out that it's no fun to hang out up here, he said. So it's hanging out he doesn't like. And the response of some Berkeley activists is, "Dear fellow activists, I propose we make the next sit-in against the sit-in laws in front of Annapurna, since they seem to be leading the charge." Of course, he's the head of the Downtown Association up there, the Berkeley Telegraph Avenue Association. "Maybe a boycott, too," says one particular writer on this People's Park community email list that I'm getting. And recently, Gina Sasso died. I've mentioned her before. She's an activist who's worked for quite a while, died kind of very young at the age of 49. She was remembered in a People's Park ceremony on Sunday. Michael Delacour, her husband, spoke there. I'm going to try to make this a little more easy to read, which is not the easiest thing for me to do here on this computer, but maybe I'll be successful. Let's see. Well, apparently it's going to be difficult for me. But never say die, that's what I say. Let's see. I'll try and get to it and see if I can pass on some of this story, which is probably, if you look up Gina Sasso, you can also find stuff about her. As I said, she's a longtime activist. She died last Wednesday, actually a week ago Wednesday, of complications of pneumonia, and she was feted Sunday in People's Park and later memorialized in an ad hoc demonstration at the corner, which was formerly the home of Cody's Books on Telegraph. That's a Telegraph in Haste, probably half a block away from Mr. Geiser's store, the Annapurna, the fellow who was, we were just reading, who was so pleased with the police driving away so-called people prone to aggressive behavior, or people prone to the behavior of hanging out. Sasso was a Berkeley activist who touched the hearts and lives of more than 75 people who showed up Sunday for a hastily assembled celebration of her life and many others. The upbeat event was organized by longtime Sasso friends Max Ventura and Soul. The sizable contingent came from the disabled community. Sasso had served for 9 years in her role as executive director of Easy Does It, an organization linking caregivers with the disabled. One of them remembered her as an effective bureaucrat who was, quote, so good she had to be fired. Despite his grief and rumors that he was hobbled by his wife's death, her husband, Michael Delacour, 73, a prominent participant in the original People's Park action back in 1969, assumed his familiar inspirational speaker's role to rouse the crowd to action to pay tribute to Gina's memory with a symbolic sitting protest after the event at the former Cody's Corner, the scene of Sasso's last protest in April. 10 loyalists who responded to Delacour's appeal to action sat down at 4 p.m. as her memorial in the park ended. Their vigil continued until 6 p.m., according to Michael Deal, a homeless advocate who vowed to step up his own activities now that Sasso is gone. In his speech, Delacour blamed the healthcare system for his wife's death, claiming that her death could be traced to her firing at Easy Does It, which caused her to lose her health benefits. She had received a bill for $1,800, according to Delacour, for treating her granddaughter's broken arm recently. It was that medical bill, he said, that had kept her from seeking treatment when her pneumonia, which she thought was the flu, persisted. How is it, Delacour asked, that we can fight three wars, but not fund health care? From eulogizing his wife, he segued into an impassioned plea to stage the spontaneous demo at Cody's after the celebration. Anyone who may have speculated his wife's death would stop Delacour doesn't know Delacour, according to close friends. Gina's last cause was opposition to a proposal backed by some owners of commercial property for Berkeley to enact a prohibition on sitting or lying down in the Telegraph and Downtown Business District. She rallied a contingent from Cody's anti-sit-lie protest in April to take the issue to the council meeting that same night in hopes of influencing swing votes on the council. According to Jesse Arguen, the District 4 city councilman whose district includes downtown, the pie-in-the-sky ordinance now might just slip away altogether since two of the pro-ordinance colleagues on the council are in fact wavering, he said. According to Arguen, even if the ordinance, which has not yet been written, were adopted, it would undoubtedly be challenged and ultimately go to Berkeley voters as a referendum. And that can happen in Santa Cruz, too. If enough people sign what's called a referendum after a city council passes something, it will go to the voters. That very rarely happens. Last time I was aware it almost happened was at the Dianza rent control destruction by Kennedy, Rotkin, and Matthews, and the council, everybody on the council, in fact, except for Ed Porter at the time. And that was way back in, I think, 2002, 2003, thereabouts. 2003, I believe, or 2004. And I believe they were also sometimes circulating a petition against the Coast Hotel project. That was also happening. Neither of these things reached the ballot, but the threat of overturning council action can have a meaningful impact on the council, and they can reconsider what they're doing. In fact, if an initiative, either I think in, I don't know about Berkeley, but in Santa Cruz, I think it's in Berkeley too, actually, that if enough signatures are gotten for what's called a referendum, different from an initiative, actually, and you have to do it within a month, you have to get about 4,000 signatures, actually several thousand more to make sure they're all legal, because you usually get a lot of illegal signatures on a in a signature drive, then the city council has the option to forestall a citizen's vote by putting the issue back on the council and reversing the council agenda and reversing their vote. So that's something that should be considered in dealing with the next draconian law that comes along, or perhaps the whole bunch of draconian laws that we've had passed piecemeal over the last few decades in Santa Cruz. Meanwhile, nevertheless, a draft of the Citlali Ordinance by the Telegraph Berkeley Improvement District group of Telly property owners moves slowly forward. A board-requested rewriting is to be submitted to the Telegraph T-Bid next week. That's Telegraph Berkeley Improvement District. All the performers at the memorial gathering, speakers as well as musicians, began their sets with personal Gina tributes, and stories. Carol Denny told of being mistakenly identified as Sasso in a demonstration and subsequently arrested. She showed up with a tribute song written just for the event, in which she immortalized Gina as "My Little Gina Girl, Who'll Be Our Sunshine Now." After hiding Saturday, the sun had appeared in time for the Sunday event. Soul presided over the stage, Soul as a person, and also performed a spoken word piece. Ernest Boom Carter, Sasso's brother-in-law, famous for drumming on Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, praised his sister-in-law and played a guitar set dedicated to her. Two of Gina's sisters, Alice and Elizabeth, were present, as well as her foster son and grandchild, Dusk and Angelina. A handful of the Funky Nixons performed Screw the Rich, and Andrea Pritchett, Copwatch founder and a close activist ally of Sasso's, sang. Several speakers recounted Sasso's 20-plus years of activism, including her support of the Memorial Stadium tree-sit protest and her 1992 opposition to UC's ultimately failed attempt to install beach volleyball courts in People's Park. That's one for in which myself and a number of Santa Cruzans were arrested, helping Berkeley activists oppose. At the time of her death, she had emerged as an effective organizer who organized her own events. She was a community advisor to Berkeley's BOSS. That's was Berkeley Outreach Support Services one time, and they changed what their words were, but not their acronym. The group which advocates for accessible housing and medically underserved Berkeleyans, and was an on-air personality at Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM, which is Berkeley's free radio. Letters of appreciation from Sasso's adoring clients at Easy Desert were read. Kathleen Stuck, a poet, activist, and close friend of Sasso's, said the last official words, and then the microphone was open to the public. One speaker said that often the most recent friends in a honeymoon state have a special loss. They lost their future with her. As the size of the hastily called event proved, Sasso was loved by many, and her death has inspired them to carry on her causes. Michael Deal has announced an anti-Citlali demonstration for June 7th, which is coming up, at 6:15 p.m. at the Old City Hall, Martin Luther King Way, 2140. A free meal will begin at 5:30, according to Deal. And here's the audio portion of a video, which you can get online, called From the Ground Up, which showed the Sasso's last demonstration, the sit-in, and has numerous interviews with people on the avenue. It's better to see it, but the audio portion of it is interesting as well. I'm going to play some of that now. In a moment, anyway. Don't go away.
Public sidewalk?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is their property.
Yeah.
Public sidewalk.
As yeah, you're right about that.
We can. This is public sidewalk, and this is private property.
To, That's the sidewalk. So if we sit on the sidewalk, you can't give us a ticket. We're not obstructing the sidewalk because it's only obstruction if a person tries to step over you.
Yeah.
If a person has to step over you to continue down the sidewalk, then it's obstruction.
What if you were, your right to sit on the sidewalk is taken away? How would it impact your life?
It wouldn't impact my life big time, but it's. I mean, I don't think impact is the right word. I think the fact that you should be able to do it.
And the person interviewing this guy, and it's really a nice little video, and you get a chance to look at it, is Gina Sasso. You can hear her voice here.
I mean, if that's part of what we're allowed to do in this country, if we're not hurting anybody, I don't see what the problem is. It's not going to impact my life where I'm going to, you know, go cry or something, or, you know, have to go seek emotional support. But, you know, if you take that away, then what's next, you know? You can't have backpacks this size. You can only have backpacks this size. What they're doing with this, by the way.
Yeah.
And, oh, well, then who decides which one's big? And then does it become color? And then pretty soon you don't like my earlobes. And then before you know it, I'm on a train going to a camp somewhere. So.
And how's the feel being out here with your dogs and stuff? It's...
That's hot up here, but it's a bit difficult outside. I mean, it makes them a stronger breed, a stronger dog, but I can tell that she's uncomfortable. She's always shivering outside. And just being over here, it actually helps because the heat from the BART station helps us out. We're not allowed to sit over here. My dog's going to freeze. Not just saying that her, she's going to freeze, but I can freeze myself. It's not only one spot we can go to that I can actually put my dog. So if they take away that... our right to sit down out there. It's gonna affect me greatly because I have no place to go. I don't have an ID yet, so I can't get a job to get an apartment. Therefore, I need places to sit down outside so I can actually get my day together and figure out what I'm gonna do. If I'm being hassled by a cop, I'm not gonna be able to do anything all day. So I'm constantly gonna be having to move around. I'll never be able to get to appointments. I won't be able to sit down somewhere and wait for my appointment. Without being hassled, I won't be able to go wait in lines for at homeless places and sit down on the sidewalk if my legs start getting tired because I'm gonna have to worry about getting a ticket somewhere.
So this line law, will affect you big time.
Greatly.
How long have you been on the streets?
I'm from Rhode Island. I've been on the streets about almost 7 years.
7 years here in California, just in general.
8 months
in California. Have you been getting cited or harassed by the police
on
often?
Telegraph, I got cited twice and it was sitting down. And I said that law hasn't been put into effect yet, so you can't really do anything about it. And I ripped the ticket up in the cops.
Yeah, so if you get cited, you should bring it down.
Because you're not blocking. You're not blocking
not
the sidewalk. I can walk. You know what I'm saying?
Blocking usually somebody...
And this is interesting. We had this discussion with Bob Offer Westor to the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness a couple weeks ago, and he pointed out that, actually it was with one of the Berkeley activists, Russell Bates, who sells bumper stickers up on Telegraph Avenue, that there is no sit-lie law in Berkeley at the moment, but the police are acting as though there is and citing people for falsely citing them for obstructing the sidewalk, which is a different situation. You have to intentionally refuse to move if somebody wants to walk by and intentionally try to obstruct them, which, of course, police can cite you for and people can get convicted of, particularly if they don't have legal help or know how to deal with the situation in court, even though they aren't doing any such thing. But, of course, it's much easier for police to go after people with a sidewalk sitting ban, as in Santa Cruz, because you don't have to show they're being obstructed and so forth. All you have to do is say, see, you sat in 95% of the sidewalk on Pacific Avenue that was illegal to sit on, even though it's broad and nobody's there. You're not blocking anyone. The store is even closed for business and empty. It doesn't matter. Now it's illegal. You broke the law. We can, you know, ticket you and so forth. However, in Berkeley, apparently, they're issuing false tickets, which, frankly, is nothing new in police departments of any nature in any city regarding poor people who can't defend themselves.
Another thing that's ridiculous about, like, me personally, I know a lot of people forget what the date is. Like, we don't know Monday, Tuesday, if it's the 5th or the 6th. That's really easy to forget out here. Plus, when we get the tickets, we're going to have to show up in court. If we don't show up in court and forget to go to the ticket, that becomes a warrant. And then that warrant leads to jail sentence.
Yeah, yeah.
Not only are we...
Thank you.
Not only are we being hassled out here on the streets, they're taking our freedom away. We're being basically kicked out of a city where we can't sit down anymore. We got to go somewhere else. It's like we're being like exiled out of here. Or the consequence is getting a jail sentence, you know, fines we can't pay. I mean, I'm out here to juggle, you know.
And then what happens? You go to Santa Rita?
Yeah.
And then they drop you, let you go in the middle of the night, and you have to try to find your way back.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of hurdles.
This is my shopping cart, too, and I'd be lucky if they take some of the gear in my shopping cart. Most likely they just leave it there on the street so it gets pillaged, and, you know. Now I'm out of everything, you know. The little I did have, you know, gets taken.
So what do you think we should do to end the stereotyping, to dissolve it?
But to know that we once too were in civilization as well. We just got, some of us have lost our jobs, some of us got evicted. So therefore, some of us are out here. Yes, the streets do demoralize some people, but it's not like that with everybody. People need to realize that, yes, we're just like everybody else walking around out here. If we get tired, yeah, we're going to want to find a place to sit down.
Right.
We're going to want, we might be able to every once in a while sit down inside of a restaurant because we get up a couple of bucks here and there, but it's not always like that. We need places outside to sit down so that we can be comfortable. That's what everybody in the world is looking for, is comfortability. By them giving us and putting that law on the plate, they're going to take away our comfortability. Then what's the relationship? Don't really have much out here to live for as it is. We're trying to survive out here, getting what we need for shelter, food, and supplies. We don't need people out here hassling us about our day-to-day activities. If we're not affecting anybody directly, leave us alone.
And that's about half of the event from the ground up. Check it out on YouTube. And that also was created, at least the narrator, or the person doing questioning, was Gina Sasso, died 49 about a week ago. Couldn't afford medical care, didn't go in soon enough on pneumonia, and another casualty, pretty young casualty of an activist who did a lot of hard work. And I remember her 20 years ago when she was doing work at the People's Park stuff, and I occasionally see her up in Berkeley. So I'm realizing that the time kind of slips away from me on these shows. Coming up shortly in about 12 minutes, hopefully we'll have Tony Ciampi coming in by phone, at least, to talk with us on the Palo Alto situation, the struggle he's been doing for the last 3 or 4 years up there to get justice from the Palo Alto courts, police department, city attorney, boy, the whole damn gang up there, sort of similar to the whole damn gang down here, it sounds like. But before that, I'll play a street interview or two because I don't want to fall too far behind because there have been some important important interviews I've had, and here's one of them.
May 26, 2004, Thursday evening at front of New Leaf, and we're talking with
Curtis Chad.
And Curtis, you had an encounter with the police last night.
It was the night before, and yeah. Boy, did I. It was Officer Winton, for no reason, used aggressive force against me, beat me with a billy club several times in the leg. It's been hard for me to walk, and it was very uncalled for. All I was doing was asking what's going on here, arms up like that, like, you know, peace, you know, and...
Well, I don't...
And the next thing, you know, he's grabbed me by the arm and beat me with his club.
This was a serious incident that I heard about from three other witnesses that happened. Well, the interview I took was on May 26th. Sounded like the incident was on May 24th or 25th and happened in the late afternoon in front of New Leaf, apparently seen by a large number of people. If anybody has more information about this incident, please get in touch with me because I want to hear other accounts. We need other witnesses, particularly video accounts of this stuff, because there was a large enough crowd that some folks had cell phones with video capabilities, and that could be very helpful in clarifying the true picture of what happened. I've also talked to at least one reporter who is willing to publicize this whole matter more broadly if he gets clearer information on it. So give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's my off-air number. Or you can call the studio line while the show goes on for the next hour at 427-3772 and get in touch with me, and we'll do some more talking about that issue. Let's take a brief musical break.
I watched the breakup of my family. Left alone, there wasn't time for me. Fell for the first guy that came my way. Held on tight and we ran away. My baby came before I turned 18. I woke up from the American dream. Her daddy struggled just to keep us fed.
Another one from A Voice of the Homeless. I believe that one was called Shuffle the Deck. So, hopefully we'll be getting a call pretty soon from Tony in Palo Alto. There is, I guess, sort of some good news. This is on another subject. Well, before I go to the other subject, let's kind of stick with the subject of tasering. There's a report that's come out by Mark Peterson Perez, or at least he reports on it for the Palo Alto Free Press, which Tony Ciampi is a writer for, or at least he's published a number of articles on the PaloAltoFreePress.com website, if you want to go check that out. Mark Peterson Perez quotes a report about tasering. Of course, people know that tasering is this electroshock, so-called less lethal weapon. I mean, it's less than lethal, but it certainly has been held accountable for a number of deaths by many people over the last decade and is in serious question in a number of cities, a subject of a number of lawsuits as well. Here's this article from June 1st, yesterday. This study looked at injuries that occur to law enforcement officers and citizens during the use of force events. Most applications of force are minimal, with officers using their hands, arms, or bodies to push or pull against a suspect to gain control. Officers are also trained to use various other force techniques and weapons to overcome resistance. These include less lethal, quote-unquote, weapons such as pepper spray, batons, which is what Chad claimed Officer Winston used against him a week ago on the street for no apparent reason, according to his account, and conducted energy devices, CED. That's sort of the polite or scientific or maybe fluffy, puffy way of saying tasers. They can also use firearms to defend themselves or others against threats of death or serious bodily injuries. What did the researchers find? The study found that when officers used force, injury rates to citizens range from 17 to 64%, depending on the agency, while officer injury rates range from 10 to 20%. Which, you know, some would say is a great thing. You don't want the, quote, good guys, which is how many people regard the police forces in different cities, as, you know, to take injuries if they're just enforcing the law. But they seem to create a significant amount of injury. And, in fact, several years ago I did a study on, or I had on the air, I think it was from the show Bad Cop, No Donut, show that used to be on Canadian radio, regarding police killings, beatings, and so forth. I think it was mostly killings throughout the country, or throughout North America, and he just simply drew from mainstream media reports. And one of the authors who was interviewed in that show, or that I picked up through that show, pointed out that there's a huge hyping of the dangers to police that simply are not justified, and that police actually cause a lot more injury than they defend against, or that is actually moved against them. So it's not hard to believe, because people who are justified and sanctified and protected in using force often come to feel regarded as a control device for other people if their authority is not instantly or speedily accepted and kowtowed to, regardless of whether it's valid in any particular situation. Again, the article continues, most injuries involve minor bruises, strains, and abrasions. The study's most significant finding is that while results were not uniform across all agencies, the use of pepper spray and CEDs can significantly reduce injuries to suspects. I guess they're not shooting them dead. And the use of CEDs, tasers, can decrease injuries to officers. The researchers assert that all injuries must be taken seriously. When the police in a democracy use force and injury results, concern about police abuse arises. Lawsuits often follow. The reputation of the police is threatened. Injuries also cost money in medical bills for indigent suspects. Worker compensation claims for injured officers or damages paid out in legal settlements or judgments. What were the study's limitations? In many cases, agency supplied injury data did not allow for a detailed analysis of the seriousness of the injuries reported. And I'll read a little bit of the background of Tony's case, Tony Ciampi's case. He wrote a letter which he published to U.S. Senator Jeff Sessions in the Senate Judiciary Committee concerning criticizing U.S. Federal Judge Lucy H. Coe's decision, which dismissed his case against the city and the police. I have a civil case before Judge Lucy Coe. Coe dismissed the thrust in my case in complete contradiction to the facts and the law, essentially eliminating it, and in so doing, concealed some of the most outrageous acts and egregious violations of law committed by a law enforcement agency in our nation's history. I think that sounds a little hyperbolic to me, but let's read on. That's a little, as I say, a little hyperbole, maybe a little exaggeration, but certainly tasering without justification, false arrest, these are all things that can be very traumatic, abusive, and I'm more than familiar with this as a persistent reality for police departments in the different cities I've lived in and been acquainted with. Mr. Sessions and fellow members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Tony Ciampi. Palo Alto Police Chief Dennis Burns and some of his subordinate officers falsified 4 audio-video recordings and 2 taser gun data ports in order to conceal their torture of me and to falsely incriminate me of a crime. In 2008, I was charged with felony resisting arrest, which, of course, is the blanket crime that people get charged with when the police can't think of a legitimate crime. They are arresting them, and if there's any kind of resistance, or they can claim any kind of resistance, even if the arrest is completely illegitimate, they will then charge you with a more serious crime of resisting arrest. Superior Court Judge Thang Barrett dismissed the case against me, citing that the officers violated my Fourth Amendment constitutional rights by unlawfully detaining me. Judge Koh overturned Judge Barrett's decision, dismissing my case for all intents and purposes. And I think, who knows, that could be our man calling in right now. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, this is Tony Ciampi calling in to talk to Robert.
Hey, Tony, this is Robert, and it's Ciampi, not Ciampi. I apologize.
Either way is fine.
Okay, I was just reading aloud your letter to Jeff Sessions, though I don't think why you would write him, I don't know. I don't think he's going to give you much justice, but welcome to Free Radio.
Thank you.
You know, I've kind of given my vague and I'm sure imperfect sense, having read some of your emails over the years, that you're such a prolific writer that I can't really claim to have read anywhere near most of them. Can you give us a kind of a thumbnail summary of what's been going down, where it all began with you and the Palo Alto police?
Sure enough. In March 2008, I was sleeping in my vehicle in a public street at 10 o'clock in the morning. There is no law in Palo Alto against sleeping in your vehicle day or night. The officers approached me and demanded that I exit the vehicle and produce identification. And I stated to them that I didn't want to and I didn't have to. And that's where they started to asserting that I was in violation of a sleeping ordinance. We went back and forth. The officers stated that they were going to come back with a tow truck. At that point, I realized I was going to have to exit the vehicle. Once I exited the vehicle, I started demanding that they cite the ordinance, of which they refused. It came to an impasse. One of the officers stated that I was under arrest, to which I picked up, again, I'm sort of glossing over some of the particulars to help streamline this.
Sure, although feel free to, you know, be as specific as you want.
Okay. A lot of this can be found if you go to where you were reading the letter to the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. At the bottom of that page is a bunch of links to my briefs filed with the court, and anybody who wants to know the details, it's all right there. My opposition to their motion for summary judgment and follow-up briefs, so it's all detailed. Back to March.
March 2008, right?
March 2008. So I go to pick up my cell phone to call for help. The officers rush me and pull out their taser guns. Now this is where fantasy meets reality, and this is why I know you refer to it as hyperbole, but if I don't think it's ever going to happen. If I were to ever obtain the original videos and contrast them to the fabricated videos, you would realize that it's not hyperbole.
Well, when I said hyperbole, what I meant was let me interrupt you for a moment, Tony. I'm not suggesting there isn't. Because, frankly, I mean, I haven't seen in the documentation on either side, but I'm not suggesting that there isn't quite probably a real, cooked-up bullshit scene going on here. But you, on the other hand, are still alive to talk about it. I can think of other people who aren't. And, therefore, compared to their cases, that's all I'm saying. That's
oh,
why
I, no, I, yeah. I totally agree with you there. Yeah.
So I'm glad you're alive to talk about it. Go ahead.
I would just, I guess... the caveat is the degree of which they were able to edit the videos portray me in an entirely negative light, not necessarily a positive light, but removing all of their negative actions and violent actions. That's what I'm referring to. it was basically a little perfect storm for them to be able to do this as the way the circumstances evolved during the incident.
So you, how long did it take you to get those videos, by the way?
Well, initially, when I was arrested on March 15th, the first video came in the last week of April, so about 6 weeks later, and it was just the one damaging MAV video. MAV is Mobile Audio Visual System. It's a camera that is mounted in the patrol car and a microphone that is mounted on, or I shouldn't say mounted, but attached to the officer either on his pistol belt or somewhere else. So they provided this one MAV. It didn't have any audio. The explanation is that the battery to the microphone ran out of power, which they really haven't come up with a good explanation as to how it ran out of power. Subsequently, they sent a secondary MAV video that didn't capture any visual of the scene, but it did, you know, it was the audio that they edited in that MAV recording that they provided. And then it was around May 29th, May 30th, at a pretrial conference in which the deputy DA, Deborah Medved, who had my case at the time, stated to my attorney at the time, David Bouvet, who you know, that there were no taser videos. So I pointed to, it was around page 4 in the police report, two taser videos documented into evidence. Over that weekend, several local residents contacted the city requesting those taser videos, and then the DA produced the taser videos the following Monday or the following Tuesday.
So you requested them weeks before, and they weren't provided, and then when you pointed this out at the pretrial conference and you got backup from other people, suddenly they appeared? Or some version of them?
Yeah, the DA didn't offer them up. The police didn't offer them up. It was only due to community pressure. And then the other thing you have to realize, I thought all along that the data ports in the taser guns themselves would be and should be tamper-proof, and I believe that they are technically, as long as, you know, taser or some other expert is not involved in the tampering. According to the Palo Alto Police Department's policy, the downloaded activation reports are to be included with the original police report. The original police report was filed with the DA's office, I believe it was March 23rd, about a week after the incident. I complained up till August 5th, 4 months, for those activation reports, and they were denying those reports until...
What are activation reports? Let me interrupt you.
Is the taser gun... Most taser guns don't have cameras, but all taser guns, at least that law enforcement agencies use, that I know of, have what's called a data port, which is basically a memory device in the taser gun itself that documents the number of times and the duration of electrical discharge. And it retains the last 1,500 firings. So it's supposed to be a mechanism used to ensure accountability. And in my case, that did not happen.
Let me get you to go back, because I interrupted you in the midst of your narrative, which I think is really what people are interested in hearing. And you were at the point, although, again, as I understand it, you had been peacefully sleeping in your vehicle, and some neighbors didn't like you being in the area, so they complained, and the police used that as a, you know, sort of a get out of here, get out of town, or we're going to tow your vehicle shit deal.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
So go ahead. But you got out of the vehicle and you.
So so I'm, you know, confronted with three officers who are being obstinate, refusing to identify the ordinance that they claim that I'm violating because there is no ordinance. We get to an impasse, and basically when Officer Berger states that I'm under arrest, to which I pick up my cell phone, and to which they draw their taser guns. And then again, this is where fantasy meets reality. I'm going to tell you what occurred what occurred is not on the video.
Go ahead.
The officers order me up against the residential fence. I wasn't parked in front of a house, as they claim over and over again. It's a 6-foot-tall residential fence with an 8-foot-tall hedge on top of it. I walk over to the residential fence. I turn around. My hands are in the air next to my head. The cell phone is in my right hand. The call is going off. It's still ringing. The officer, Berger, tells me to put my hands behind my back. And I look at the phone. I look back at him. I go, just let me make this phone call first. And without saying a word, he's during this time period, there's a laser sight on the taser gun. And he's flashing it in and out of my eyes. And it goes off as he's aiming it at my face. Fortunately, because my hands were in the air next to my head, all I had to do was move my left arm in front of my face, and I spun in place, and the top taser probe lodged in my left arm. The bottom one grazed my chin, causing a small cut. This is where they claim that the taser didn't work because both probes weren't embedded into me. However, even though I don't have an expert verifying this in my case, I have talked to various electrical engineers, and you don't need both probes to be in you for the taser gun to discharge electricity. Officer Berger began to discharge electricity for, approximately 7 to 10 seconds, during which time I was pleading with him to stop shocking me. He's standing a few feet away from me, and this is where, you know, your human instinct takes over, and I went to knock the taser gun out of his hands. I hit the taser gun, and he backed away, and the electricity stopped. That tells me that most definitely he'd been shocking me more than 5 seconds, because when a taser gun, when they pull the trigger, it's going to discharge for 5 seconds, even if they let go of the trigger. It's called a cycle, a 5-second cycle. If they hold the trigger down, it'll discharge electricity for past 5 seconds. It'll keep discharging electricity up to, I'm guessing here a little bit, approximately 128 seconds.
Now, let me ask you, you say that there were two charges were fired at you. One hit you in the arm, and the other hit you in the chin, or just grazed your chin, and
just
only
grazed
one.
Grazed my chin, and I believe it went over the residential fence.
I see.
The one that hit my arm and lodged in my arm, and basically when he was shocking me, I could feel the current traveling through my arm into my chest and down my torso, and this is where I spoke with a couple of different electrical engineers that are saying, well, the current was going, you know, basically through your body to the probe that was on the ground. It hadn't been raining a lot, but the pavement was wet. Everything was wet, so that didn't help.
And this was at night or during the day? Or
it was 10 o'clock in the morning. Yeah.
Go ahead. This is your first tasering experience, I take it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Hopefully your last tasering experience.
I hope so, yes.
Yeah.
So basically the incident you would think would be over. The two other officers grabbed me from each side and thinking that's it. However, this officer who shot me, Officer Berger, decided he wanted to shock me some more. I wasn't moving. I wasn't resisting. Two other officers had a hold of me, and so Officer Berger pulls the trigger on his taser gun again and starts pumping me full of electricity. And now this goes on for 20-some-odd seconds, during which I'm trying to get away from the officers, and they're trying to get a hold of me.
Did any of the other officers object to this procedure or express any kind of dissent?
Oh, absolutely not, no. I do believe that there's a lot of editing going on with the audio recordings on the taser camera recordings and Officer Berger's MAV recording. At one point you hear Officer Wagner go, "Oh, God." And I do believe that was her reaction to Officer Berger initially firing his taser gun. It doesn't match up to what how it's currently portrayed in the recordings. But it definitely took everybody by surprise.
So you were shocked again for 20 more seconds, and
during which time the other officer fired his taser gun, hitting me in the rear end, and the other probe lodging into the fence, the residential fence. I don't believe I felt any electricity from that firing. However, he discarded that cartridge from his taser gun and went to the drive stun mode and then began to drive stun me.
Explain what that means.
I think everyone knows what a stun gun is, and basically that's what it is. The taser gun just turns into a typical stun gun that has two leads on it and an arc of electricity going between the two leads, and you know, it is press it up against your body to deliver painful shock of electricity.
So the difference is a taser can be used at a distance, but a stun gun has to be used with contact?
Yes, yes.
Go ahead.
So when they refer to a taser in a drive stun mode, basically it's being used as a stun gun. A taser is basically a stun gun that is being used at a distance, you know, firing the probes away from the gun into the person, and then the taser gun in that, using it in the taser mode, delivers a lot more electricity to the human body, which, you know, if both probes are in it and you get the full current of electricity, typically your entire body is going to seize up.
Any witnesses to this?
No.
What kind of a neighborhood were we in here?
This is a upper-class neighborhood, yes, close to downtown Palo Alto.
And did you get the impression this was... What did the police officers want to do other than have you kowtow to their authority? In other words, rather than... Obviously, they were contesting and resisting and ignoring your attempt to get a response to why are you stopping me, what law is involved, but what was their objective? What did they tell you that they supposedly wanted?
Well, they kept stating to me that I was violating some sleeping ordinance, and, you know, it was basically we never even got beyond that. Officer Wagner wrote in the report that she asked for my identification a couple of times, but
this was after the whole tasering.
Yeah, she never actually verbally asked for my identification. While I was before I exited the vehicle the first time, Officer Wagner and Officer Tamores were just initially we need to talk to you, and well, I don't want to talk to you, and then that's where they went into their ploy of stating that I was violating a non-existent sleeping ordinance.
And they threatened to tow your vehicle unless you got out and talked to them?
Yeah.
And for the purposes of all our vehicularly housed residents who are listening and trying to figure out how to deal with the police here in Santa Cruz, it is illegal to sleep in your vehicle after 11 o'clock at night. Unlike in Palo Alto, which is relatively rare, it doesn't have a no sleeping in your vehicle law. Is that still the case, by the way?
Temporarily, I've been informed that they're crafting an ordinance to either ban sleeping / living out of your vehicle in Palo Alto. So when that will, they'll attempt to put that into effect, I do not know. Palo Alto, I think, is like one of the last, you know, only cities or towns in the Bay Area or the greater Bay Area that does not have an ordinance that prohibits sleeping in your vehicle.
Yeah, Palo Alto is a pretty upper class community, Stanford University and all that. What do you make of this?
What do you mean?
In other words, why haven't they emulated Santa Cruz, San Francisco,
I really don't think it's, with the exception of maybe one area where there are RVs and some campers, my impression is it's not a problem, that really isn't a problem, and that's why they haven't really done anything.
Now, were you a vehicularly housed person at that time generally, and you were living in your vehicle?
More or less, yes.
And are you still in that situation?
Yes.
Have you been harassed since then?
No, not like that, no.
I mean,
I have had, as a result of my lawsuit, I suspect, I have been followed by plainclothes officers. Once they tried to entrap me with drugs, things like that.
Uh-huh. And I've got all kinds of questions I want to go back and ask you about different aspects of this. But I guess I'm going to kind of take it as it comes, that rolls into my mind. But have you had any solidarity or support from groups, you know, supposedly concerned with civil liberties, like, well, we have a useless ACLU in Santa Cruz, but in San Francisco, sometimes the ACLU assists the Coalition on Homelessness. Sometimes it happens in Berkeley. I think it happened in Fresno. It happened in Los Angeles with the Jones case. Have you had any success or any community support from organizations like the ACLU?
No, none. I haven't received any support from anybody in that regard, or into pursuing the lawsuit.
And your case is pretty well publicized, right?
Oh yes, I let everybody know about it and what's going on. It's why I think it's one thing to violate someone's Fourth Amendment rights for an unlawful search and seizure. It's quite another to cover up your unlawful assault of that citizen by falsifying the videos. And then it's even, a greater egregious act when they, the falsification of that video not only conceals the officer's acts, but literally incriminates the citizen of a crime. That's where I, get into how egregious this act is.
Well, also it sounds like there was an element of torture involved too.
Well, he's, I'm yelling at him to stop shocking me. I'm not going anywhere. The initial firing, and he's refusing to stop shocking me, and I just reacted.
And then the subsequent.
And then the subsequent one was totally unnecessary, which resulted in, the altercation ensuing for several, probably 30 more seconds.
And we've had a tasering death in custody here some years ago, 2005. David Anthony Cross was killed, some say murdered, by sheriff's deputies in custody when he was tasered. Have you done much research to kind of, I'm going to jump around here, around tasering, or had much communication with other folks who've been tased, either in Palo Alto or elsewhere?
Not really. I forget his first name. I think it's Todd, but the McPherson case from Los Angeles.
Don't know it, but go ahead.
It's the Ninth Circuit Court's ruling that initially laid down the case law that tasers are, a medium, I guess.
Less lethal?
It's less lethal, but it's greater than most non-lethal uses of force, the significant use of force. And initially they ruled in the McPherson case that for McPherson, they subsequently overturned themselves, stating that at the time that the incident occurred, the law had not been established.
So the police were innocent because they didn't know the law, or there was no law supposedly stopping them from tasering McPherson. Although I don't know I'm not familiar with that case, and I don't know
if he was. I forget the complete details. He was driving his car in his shorts. He got pulled over, I believe, for a seatbelt violation. He got out of the vehicle, And then I guess there was some verbal confrontation. I guess he was somewhat agitated, not necessarily at the officer, but just he was having a bad morning. And he got shot with a taser. And I do believe in that incident, only one probe hit him as well. The officer lied in the police report, said that he was coming at him. The problem with that is the probe that lodged into him lodged somewhere in his backside, in his back, so he could not have been facing him.
Well, he obviously was attacking him with his back.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. So, but then the court found that, you know, even if all that was true, well, nonetheless, those police officers, it wasn't really the existing law at the time, and therefore, oh, well.
Exactly.
And you experienced, I guess, a similar situation from Judge Koh, who, once the felony assault charge was dropped because a judge found this was pretty funny business with taser, with, I guess, videos disappearing and possibly being altered, and also no law being any basis for an initial, even reasonable suspicion, much less probable cause, you were, your case was dismissed, and then you sued, but then when you got to Koh's court, she dismissed it, right?
More or less. I mean, it's still alive, but, by a thread. I filed a, let me back up. It was Judge Thang Barrett who dismissed the case.
Again, give me his name.
Thang Barrett.
How do you spell it?
B-A-R-R-E-T-T. And the first name is Thang, T-H-A-N-G.
Thang Barrett.
Yes. Now, the interesting thing about that case is the DA, who had this very incriminating video of me going at Officer Berger, did not show Thang Barrett the video to get it my case bound over for trial. Yet he showed it to a newspaper reporter prior to Thang Barrett giving his decision. That was the result of my ability to get a forensic expert to conduct a cursory analysis on the taser videos, which initially concluded that they had been tampered with, edited, and having footage removed. So the DA obviously continued to prosecute me. They didn't drop the charges, but they didn't really use any of the hard evidence. Thang Barrett saw that these officers were basically lying. They had no probable cause or even reasonable suspicion. And that's why he dismissed the case.
At what stage of the proceedings was the case dismissed? Did you, prior to a jury trial?
Yes. It was. It's called a preliminary examination. It's like a mini trial to determine, in a felony case, it's like a mini trial to determine whether or not the case should go forward.
When was what month was that?
That was December 2008.
And I've occasionally been to Palo Alto and been in touch with some homeless activists there years ago, not so much recently. I mean, most recently, the only thing I've been reading about is, to some extent, your case and the case of Victor Frost. You ever met him?
Yes. Yeah.
And is there any love lost between you? I mean, do you have any mutual sympathies for each other's situation, mutual support in any way?
Not really, but, he does his thing, basically, the city has, it's quite obvious that the city has selectively enforced their sit lie ordinance and targeted him.
Victor Frost is a guy who's run for city council. He's a homeless guy who sits on the sidewalk and he panhandles in areas that he's not supposed to panhandle, and he essentially has successfully fought off attempts to criminalize that in his own case.
Yes, that's pretty much. And ironically, here's the interesting connection, is Judge Koh initially ruled in his case that the city's sit lie ordinance in targeting him was not unconstitutional. I haven't looked at the actual decision, but there is a quote of the decision in a local newspaper called the Palo Alto Weekly, in which Chechko's reasoning is, even if the city's ordinance and or actions violated Victor Frost's rights, because the defendants, Victor Frost, did not prove any intent on the city of violating his rights, therefore, I guess the way she, I don't know how she ends that.
Maybe they have an immunity or some such thing. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's
although he's not trying to sue them, right? He's just trying to avoid criminal prosecution.
Yeah.
And he's somewhat more, he's more high profile than you in the sense that he's sort of out there in the limelight, raising issues. I mean, you're not fighting a specific law as I guess he is, although you would, I assume, support him in the sense that you feel he's being unfairly targeted, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the rationale of the whole ordinance is bogus. There are seats and chairs and people sitting on the sidewalk all over town. You have obstructions of the sidewalk all over town. The whole justification for the ordinance is that they don't want people sitting or lying on the sidewalk obstructing citizens in their ability to walk freely up and down the sidewalk.
It's the trip. Well,
Victor Frost he takes up the space of basically his body space on the sidewalk. He's not obstructing the flow of traffic in any way.
Just as you yourself were trying to sleep in your vehicle or be in your vehicle without being molested by the police or other private citizens, and then were in fact interrupted in enjoying the peace of your vehicle.
Exactly. The hypocrisy here is compelling in that I think the police were tried in 2004, 2005, but I don't know if you recall the Hopkins case.
Tell us about it.
Albert Hopkins was, recently divorced from his wife, and he was living in his car because he didn't want to pay the cost of a hotel until he got better situated. The police show up, almost identical scenario in which they ask for identification. He initially doesn't want to provide it. One thing leads to another where the officers state that when he comes out of the car, he pushed the door open, hit an officer, and the next thing you know, the officers are pepper spraying him and beating him with batons, which ended up he ended up requiring surgery on one of his knees.
This is in Palo Alto, or?
Yes. And in that situation, the supervisors came on scene and determined that the two officers had no reasonable suspicion to be detaining him, and therefore their use of force was unlawful.
And so, of course, they were immediately fired and then tried for assault, right?
No, they're still on the force today. They were tried. They were prosecuted by the Santa Clara County DA.
Wow.
And you have Deputy DA Peter Waite. I quote him quite often because it was his decision, his statements during that trial about you don't have to show your identification to officers if you're lawfully existing on a street. You don't have to, if you're sitting in your car, sleeping in your car. It's good, it's sometimes good for citizens to stand up for your rights. That's why it's what separates America from all other countries. We're free to be on the street without being accosted by government agents.
Tell me another one, won't you, Tony?
Yeah. So these, Con and Lee, I think their first names, David Lee and Michael Con, I believe.
How do you spell Con?
K-A-N.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And
these are the officers?
Yeah, the two officers. So they were prosecuted. The DA had the foresight to put two Asian officers, to put four Asian Americans on the jury, and it came down to an 8-4 split. The four Asians voted to acquit. So these two officers got off. They ended, the DA didn't retry them. They pled to an infraction, and so that they could remain on the Palo Alto Police Department.
And has their behavior improved?
Well, obviously not. Not in my case. In fact,
no, I don't mean the Palo Alto. I don't mean the police department, but I mean those two officers.
I don't know.
But
I
the police department is still apparently it's getting worse. It isn't even, and the DA is not prosecuting these officers who tasered you, right?
Of course not. The DA is, as far as I'm concerned, is complicit in the cover-up.
Now,
the
is this
DA,
the same
the
DA or a different DA?
Well, it's the same DA's office. At that time, it was George Kennedy. Then you had Dolores Carr take over, who was the DA during my criminal case and the subsequent the year or so. Jeff Rosen has been the DA since January, and I've been hitting Jeff Rosen with my evidence since he's taken over. I hit Dolores Carr with all my evidence. You have to realize that the Santa Clara County Crime Lab, they did their best to not investigate and or come up with other conclusions other than that the videos and taser gun activation reports have been tampered with. You have one of the crime lab analysts, Christopher Capora, mating up the two taser videos together, and they don't match up. There's a discrepancy of 4 seconds between the beginning and ending of the two taser videos. Apparently that's not that's not a red flag or some kind of indication that tampering has occurred. You have another one, John Burke, who's the supervising analyst, stating that both taser videos, the frames are, quote, improperly indexed.
There's been a lot of publicity about the San Francisco Police Department's corruption in terms of, cops stealing drugs and making searches without probable cause, video documented, and I guess the public defender's office has effectively embarrassed the former police chief, now DA of San Francisco. Do you think this has had any impact on Palo Alto and your area?
No, I really don't. No, not at all.
And have you sought any kind of outside assistance? I know you're looking for attorneys now, are you not, to take your case and trying to reverse the summary dismissal?
I kind of gave up a while back. Given that the police have been in control of the evidence and they've destroyed it all, and I guess some of the other circumstances surrounding the case, it's been a very difficult task. There's still that potential, I wouldn't say that I'm actively pursuing that at the moment. I think I was about to mention a little while ago that I have filed, it's called a motion for leave to file a motion for reconsideration. And what that is, a motion for reconsideration is, basically to present new and or re-argue some of the facts that weren't maybe argued thoroughly initially in my opposition to the motion for summary judgment. And before you can do that, you have to get leave from the court, which is called a motion for leave. So I cited the reasons why I believe I should be permitted to file the motion for reconsideration in my motion for leave, and that
before we get deeply into this, Tony, because I think it's something that, again, I'm talking to an audience of people who may have an attention span even more limited than mine.
No, I know it gets very convoluted.
Yeah, well, but also you're dealing with legal issues that do require very careful and specific analysis and justification and argument, which is what you've been doing for the last couple of years and what you've been writing about. But the fact is that you are still continuing to write about this on the website Palo Alto Daily. What's the actual website your stuff is?
Palo Alto Free Press.
Yeah, the Palo. So you are still articulating this case. And what's happened? I guess I'm wondering. I mean, I know I mean, I've been concerned with these issues for several decades in Santa Cruz, and how they impact people who live outside or in their vehicles, because you folks are the most vulnerable to this kind of crap. And one approach is to take a legal, this is unconstitutional stuff. This is violation of rights. This is outrageous, which it is. But the problem is that such things require attorneys, money, some kind of confidence in the courts, which I don't have, incidentally, in spite of the fact that, you know, the same attorney that you were using, David Beauvais, is, you know, maybe successful, maybe in getting me a new trial around this case I have in Santa Cruz, which is the, you know, false arrest at city council that I had. But the real issue is the broader issue of stopping police departments from doing this kind of stuff and mobilizing people to know their rights on these issues. I notice your focus is very, I don't want to call it legalistic, but it is, I guess, in a way, very, very much focused on getting some kind of arguing that the law, the law, the Constitution in this case, has been violated. Have you been able, and I mean, you seem to have interested some media in this case. Do you have sympathizers in the media who are supporters of exposing this kind of stuff and stopping it?
Well, the only person who, local media, is the Palo Alto Free Press and the editor, Mark Peterson Perez. Other than that, initially, there was some interest. I shouldn't say there's not, I'll just say that they're very cautious in how they, the local media, has presented this story. The other, you know, hard print papers in the area. The
television, you know, radio. What about those folks?
No, nobody's been interested.
City council members have not called you into hearings to examine and police department policies.
No.
FBI investigation of civil rights violations.
No.
Of course, we know that, you know, Ashcroft was cleared of torture by a unanimous Supreme Court. He's not supposed to be challenged because, after all, it might interfere with his duties. You've got to, that's our system of justice. I mean, show some respect, okay? So, how much time and money has all this cost you, in your view? How many hours and how many dollars have you spent on this struggle?
Well, I'm not going to put a dollar figure on it. I will say that I put in the last year, you could pretty much say I've worked full time on it, Monday through Sunday. you know, with days off here and there, half days here and there. But, I've been working on one aspect of the case or another, or doing something like trying to get some attention from the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, which is interesting because in, I believe it was January 2008, a couple months before my incident, that they conducted a hearing in which they criticized the Santa Clara County Crime Lab for putting forth a bogus analysis which convicted an innocent person of a crime and then conducted an internal investigation which found no wrongdoing. You have Senator Patrick Leahy going on about how this seems to, I don't know what law he was referring to, but the practice of internal investigation in this type of a matter goes counter to the law that he helped draft.
And that is, of course, also the issue in San Francisco, that the many drug convictions had to be reversed because of the, well, as they should be, all these drug convictions should be thrown out to begin with,
yeah.
But, you know, because of the theft of material and, you know, corruption in the drug labs. But now that the case is hanging by a thread, and I know you're looking for more stuff, but you may not be terribly hopeful about proceeding on this. I don't know. If you looked back on this, would you have made a different decision, do you think? And you knew what you knew, everything that was going to happen. What would you have done differently on that day, if anything, when the police came to your vehicle? And I know that's very hypothetical.
Well, there's nothing that I would have or could have done differently. Let's put it that way. My reaction to being perpetually shocked with electricity wasn't there wasn't a thought to react to it. It was just I knew I needed to have that electricity stop at that moment.
No, I understand that, but let's suppose you could go back in a time machine and talk to yourself an hour before this happened. What kind of advice would you give yourself? And I ask this question because there are going to be people in their vehicles confronted with this situation and are being confronted with this situation in other cities and, again, and even in Palo Alto.
Yeah, if you don't have the, you know, I'm sure that these officers thought that once they sent me off to jail, they were never going to see me again. Therefore, they didn't have anything to worry about, and which emboldened them to conduct all the tampering that they did. In most cases, there's probably not video, or they just get rid of the video and don't tell anybody about it. So, you know, it's a very difficult situation for people who are vulnerable to being abused and exploited by law enforcement. Obviously, you know, if my last name were Jobs and was, you know, a distant cousin of Steve Jobs or something, I highly doubt that the outcome of my case would have, you know, it would not have gone the route that it did.
Is there any racial element in any of this?
Well, you know, I don't, you know, humans hate humans. For all a variety of reasons, and you could say the same hatred that you know motivates someone who is a racist. It's the same kind of hatred that motivates those who have power over those who they deem less than themselves.
Well, I think it's hatred of your unwillingness to instantly obey. That's, I think, the sickness of this whole power structure. You are forced to, you know, they are put in a position where they're led to expect you to obey, and you're put in a position where if you don't, you have to risk this kind of abusive behavior. But let me jump again to this. Let's suppose you're driving with someone else in a vehicle, and the police stop you, or you know you're sitting with someone talking to them, and the police come by and say you can't, you know, and they confront you with him with a situation or her with a situation. What would you advise this person to do? Would you have any advice for them, or would you just say what would you say?
So right now, what you're saying, a circumstance in which two people are sitting in a parked car. Lawfully existing.
Right, police officer comes up and says, we'd like to talk to you. Please get out of your vehicle, sir and ma'am.
I would still do the same thing. I would say, why do you want to talk to me? And if they don't come up with a justifiable reason, I would say, well, I don't want to talk to you. And that's why we live here in America.
No, I understand. Yeah. Would you advise... So in other words, in spite of this experience, in spite of the fact that even with the legal assistance you got, even with the clear doctored videos as you viewed it, even with the dismissal that you got and then the subsequent overturning of that dismissal, or it wasn't overturning the dismissal, but it was overturning of the civil lawsuit that you tried to hold the officers accountable and the police department accountable for their behavior, the failure of all that, you think it would be worth your time and energy to risk that whole thing again? You would do the same thing again if it happened, do you think?
Well, yeah. Absolutely. We have okay. to. You have to. Otherwise, you know, then the Fourth Amendment doesn't mean anything.
Well, to those folks in Guantanamo and to Bradley Manning, I don't think it means much at the current time.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
I agree with you, by the way. I tend to do the same thing, though I got to admit, I can't really predict what I'm going to do when a police officer shines a flashlight in my face at night, you know. says, get out of the car or stay in the car, sir, and put your hands on the wheel, whatever they say. You know, I mean, it's a difficult situation when you live in what is essentially a police state.
It depends on the circumstances,
Well, you know, so we're talking with Tony Ciampi of Palo Alto, who you can read more, whose case, you know, is described in some detail in the Palo Alto Free Press. Is that a good place to go? Just sort of search for Tony Ciampi, C-I-M-P-I, and go to the Palo Alto Free Press, and you can catch some of the background pretty quickly in this case?
Yes, I think that's it's a great site, and they have a lot of other informative articles regarding abuse of the police and standing up for the average citizen.
Now, I know that, and we're almost done here, by the way, because I'm running out of time, getting close to the end of the show. If anybody has any questions who's listening wants to call in, we may be able to catch you on a second line, 469-3119, 469-3119. Are you up for any questions if anybody chooses to ask you those questions, Tony?
For a couple minutes, sir.
Okay. One question I have is I sometimes have conflicts with attorneys who want to pursue one strategy. I want to pursue another. Have you had that kind of difficulty with attorneys you've been involved with?
Well, absolutely.
And can you make any general statements about, well, you can talk about your specific case if you want, but I think more important is for an activist, and you're an activist in the sense that you are certainly a person who is concerned with making sure the police department doesn't do this to the next person, doesn't do this to you again, and is held accountable for what they did do. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
You want that to come out of the case rather than, you know, I don't know, getting a settlement of some kind or, you know, getting a reduction in your sentence or whatever the hell. How can you approach an attorney to, should we say, engage in appropriate attorney control in these kinds of cases?
I don't know yet. I don't know how, you know, if you don't, if you're working with limited resources, as I am, you don't have much control at all.
Let me ask you, what are the problems that have come up with attorneys that you've been with, that where you found yourself at odds with them? What are the difficulties you're likely to encounter somebody
in? Well, the attorney who took my civil case initially, it was pretty, I made it very clear that, you know, the main focus of this case is going after the 14th Amendment violation of my due process of the officers tampering with the evidence, the audio and video recordings and the taser data. 9 months into the case, in a roundabout way, it came clear that he did not want to pursue that. There was nothing I can do.
What was his rationalization or his reason for not wanting to pursue it?
He claimed the evidence wasn't there. Well, the evidence is there. The problem is, as I found out, that...
You need expert testimony?
You need expert testimony to say pretty much what I have been saying.
Which costs money.
Exactly.
And he didn't want to front the money.
Exactly.
So it a lot of this does boil down to money. Any other issues that came up?
I think that's it. If you're going to get an attorney, you need to
have money.
Yeah.
Right.
But you know, clearly defined what the objective is at the outset, and have it written into the contract that if either party deviates from that objective, then the contract is null and void, or work something else out. The problem is you start out, it's all kind of generalized when you sign a contract with an attorney that they're going to pursue legal action on your behalf against the city of Palo Alto in this particular incident, but nothing is really in the contract itself detailed or specified.
So that's what you'd do if you were going to do this again. You'd be more specific in what you sought.
I would, if the contract would be more detailed, yes.
Have you been experiencing in the last year increased or decreased levels of harassment from police for living in your vehicle?
Well, that they pretty much avoided because it obviously, I should say obviously, but I imagine that should they continue to harass me in my vehicle unlawfully, because there is no law, that it would provide me more ammunition for my civil case and justifying it.
Do you anticipate an upswing in harassment based on the fact that your civil case is likely to go away now?
Yes.
In a word.
Yeah. Obviously not yet, because it hasn't gone away completely, but as soon as it does, I imagine that as soon as my case is over with, they will enact their sleeping ordinance, and the harassment will definitely increase.
Are you going to go testify against the sleeping ordinance at City Council?
I'm not sure what I'll do about that.
Have you actually? Is there a date for its arrival, or is it just sort of currently unclearly maybe coming up? I know in Berkeley they are uncertain about whether the sit-lie ordinance is going to come up.
There's nothing on any agenda that I know of. I've been informed by city staff that they're in the works of putting it together.
Well, we've been talking with Tony Ciampi of Palo Alto, who has fought for 3 years to get some kind of justice after an incident involving harassment in his vehicle, tasering. Did you get medical treatment, by the way, for your tasering?
Yes, it's policy. Anytime that Palo Alto uses a taser on a citizen, they take them to the hospital to be checked out. It was pretty cursory. No lasting injuries from the tasering that I know of.
How did you feel the next night when you went to sleep in your vehicle is my question.
More frightened than anything, I guess.
Right. Torture has implications far beyond the moment of the torturing.
Yeah. Well, the huge shock, no pun intended, was when I saw the first video that had been tampered with. For a month and a half, I'm thinking, well, as soon as we get the videos, I'm off the hook, and these officers are going to be on the hook. And then when I see the video, I'm thinking, I'm going to prison, and they're using a falsified video to put me there. So that was probably the most devastating day of any of them.
Well, Tony, I've run out of time, and I do appreciate your finally giving this interview. I know it's taken you a while because you didn't want to compromise your legal case, and I don't know, but I'm glad that you finally come on the air to talk about it, and this is going to be archived. If people are interested in listening to it later, give a call to the Huff Line to get the archive address, 423-4833. Any last words?
Not really. I guess that pretty much covers it. I don't know what else to say. Just,
please feel free to give us a call if any further incidents happen or if there are any developments in the case, because I want to follow it.
Sure enough.
Appreciate.
Hi, Robert. Thank
you
much.
Hey, thank you, man.
All right.
All righty. Bye-bye. And it's 1 minute to 8, and in the studio is the inimitable and irrepressible Uncle Dennis, who is presiding over a dying radio station. So for all you radio broadcasters and all you people out there, support free radio before it disappears under the waves. I think we have, two people left who are active in this radio station, one of whom is in the studio with me now. Dennis will be talking to you in great detail about this.
Your excuse for not showing up at meetings?
I don't want to be a disruptive influence in the meeting. I mean, I might be, have to be excluded from the area. Who knows? Anyway, I'll be back on...
Your presence doesn't have to be disruptive.
Certainly
not. You could constructive.
Always.
You could put valuable input.
Oh, you dreamer, you. What can I tell you, Dennis? You're a man of vision, but sometimes your heart is bigger than your tummy. we won't get into that. So I'll be back on Sunday. If I happen to wander into the studio, that'll be at sometime after Thomas Levitt doesn't show up, probably around 9:30. Actually,
Thomas, there is a radio show on Sunday morning.
Yes, Thomas, there is a radio show. And maybe he will show up. Who knows? Maybe he'll actually get the Huff website up again. We can always dream of these issues, and hopefully that'll happen. I want to appreciate, thank you, probably go off and get something to eat so I can clear off my tongue. My tongue gets a little floppy this time of night. Do thank you for listening to the show. If you want to get in touch between times, you can call the Huff line at 423-HUFF, and then I will get back to you on 9:30 in the morning on Sunday. If we all get together at that time, then that's what's going to happen. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Oh.